Morning, everybody. It's great to be with you. And if we can get my slides up, we'll make a start. We're going to start with a picture, if we can get on, Jeff. And I want you to start by telling me if you can guess who this gentleman is. Any ideas? No, it's not Moses, although I can understand why you may think it's Moses, which I'll explain in a moment. If I told you it was Elijah or Jeremiah or Isaiah or Moses, you'd believe me, wouldn't you? But actually, I want to tell you that this particular image is actually Abraham. And the reason I know it's Abraham is that AI is just such an incredible thing these days. And they actually went back in history and found a genuine Polaroid photograph of Abraham, and they enhanced it. And there's a couple of these I've got to show you today. And there is actually a remarkable resemblance, in my opinion, to Charlton Heston. In a couple of the others, even more so. And that's why, Helen, I think probably we all know that Moses does definitely look like Charlton Heston because of the Ten Commandments. Nothing to do with Ben-Hur. Anyway, I'm going to talk to you today about Abraham. And I want to revisit a story that I know I preached about here not that long ago. We came, I think it was about 12 months ago, and we delivered a series of messages about the names of God. And I spoke here about Jehovah Jireh, God the Provider, and I used the story of Abraham and Isaac then. Well, I want to revisit it, but I'm looking at this from hopefully a completely different perspective this morning. I want to talk about Abraham and the story when he was called and tested to sacrifice his son Isaac. But the context of this story is that Abraham had Isaac in extreme old age, and Isaac was the son of a promise. And it's hard to underestimate just how important that promise was, because the whole of God's relationship with mankind actually hinged on that promise being fulfilled. If what God promised through Isaac hadn't have happened, we wouldn't have had the rise of the Jewish nation. We wouldn't have ultimately had Jesus. So Isaac was incredibly important, and we're going to be looking at this. But what I want to do to start with is I want to just give you a little bit of background. So we're going to have a tiny little bit of a history lesson, and we're going to dig back and look at the story of Abraham, as he was called before he became Abraham. And we're going to look at the call of Abraham and then look a little bit at what had happened in his life to get him to this story of Abraham and Isaac. So the first thing is that it was, let's see if this is working. Wow, look at this, fantastic. It was estimated that Abraham was about 75 years old when this happened. So this is from Genesis chapter 12. The Lord had said to Abraham, "Go from your country, your people, and your father's household to the land I will show you. I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse, and all peoples on earth will be blessed through you." So we'll have another look at Abram just while I talk about those few verses. Now, excuse me, this was a really big deal. Abraham was 75 years old when God spoke to him in this way. And God called Abraham to become a wanderer. He called him at the age of 75, not just to leave the town that he was living in, but to leave the very country. We know that Abraham had a family. We know that he left his brother behind. So this is a really big challenge for Abraham to believe. Most people by the age of 75 are thinking about kind of putting their feet up a little bit. It's time for the carpet slippers and the pipe to come out and just kind of chill out into old age. But it was at this age that Abraham had the first call. And he started what we call sojourning. He became a wanderer and actually remained a wanderer, a sojourner for the rest of his life. But as Abraham started this new phase of his life, God makes a promise and also a covenant with Abraham. So again, just moving into Genesis chapter 15 now, we read these verses. The Lord took Abraham outside and said, "Look up at the sky and count the stars, if indeed you can count them." Then he said, "So shall your offspring be." Abraham believed the Lord, and he credited it to him as righteousness. God also said to him, verse 7, "I am the Lord who brought you out of Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to take possession of it." But Abraham said, "Sovereign Lord, how can I know that I will gain possession of it?" So, verse 18, "On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abraham and said, 'To your descendants I give this land, from the Wadi of Egypt to the great river, the Euphrates.'" So again, thanks to AI, we have a lovely picture there of Abraham looking at the stars of the sky and realizing what an amazing promise God had given him. So Abraham had received, firstly, a call from God to leave his homeland. He then received a promise from God that he would become a great nation and that he would be a blessing to all people. And then, even more so, God also gave Abraham a covenant that his offspring would inherit the promised land. So there was a call, there was a promise, and there was a covenant. And when we look at the plot of land that God promised to Abraham, we see exactly what we see on our televisions every day, the land between Egypt and the Euphrates, the promised land. There was one problem, however. Abraham had no children. His wife, Sarah, or Sarai, as she was called at the time, was barren. She was unable to have children. So Abraham and Sarah decided to take matters into their own hands. This is Genesis chapter 16. Now Sarai, Abraham's wife, had borne him no children, but she had an Egyptian slave named Hagar. So she said to Abraham, "The Lord has kept me from having children. Go sleep with my slave. Perhaps I can build a family through her." And Abraham, we're not told whether he was reluctant or not, but Abraham agreed to what Sarah said to him. So, surprise, surprise, what happens is this. Hagar, the slave girl, falls pregnant. And guess what? Sarah, rather than being thrilled that her plan has come to fruition, is actually incensed by this. She'd brought it upon herself, but she's incensed by the fact that Hagar is pregnant. So Sarah starts to badly mistreat Hagar, and Hagar runs away from the family home, and she's found by an angel. So this is later on in Genesis chapter 16. And we read these words. So Hagar's been found by this angel. "The angel of the Lord said to Hagar, 'You're now pregnant, and you will give birth to a son. You will name him Ishmael, for the Lord has heard your misery. He will be a wild donkey of a man. His hand will be against everyone, and everyone's hand against him, and he will live in hostility toward all his brothers.'" Now that is a really, really stark verse to read, because this wasn't God's idea. It wasn't God's plan for Abraham to sleep with Sarah's slave and to father this child. But Abraham had done it, and as a result of that, this man called Ishmael is born. Now Ishmael is the father of Islam. And we read here that he was a wild donkey of his man, and everyone's hand would be against him, and that he would live in hostility with his brothers. Anyway, after all of this, miraculously, Sarah falls pregnant. So again, moving on through the story, we move into Genesis chapter 21. Now the Lord was gracious to Sarah, as he had said he would be. And the Lord did for Sarah exactly what he promised. She became pregnant and bore a son to Abraham in his very old age, at the very time God had promised him. God gave the name Isaac to the son Sarah bore him. The child grew and was weaned. And on the day Isaac was weaned, Abraham held a great feast. But Sarah saw that the son whom Hagar the Egyptian had borne to Abraham was mocking. And she said to Abraham, "Get rid of that slave woman and her son, for that woman's son will never share in the inheritance with my son Isaac." The matter distressed Abraham greatly because it was his son. But God said to him, "Don't be so distressed about the boy and your slave woman. Listen to whatever Sarah tells you, because it is through Isaac that your offspring will be reckoned. I will make the son of the slave into a nation also, because he is your offspring." So early the next morning, Abraham took some food and a skin of water. He gave them to Hagar and set them on her shoulders and sent her off with the boy. That sounds really harsh, doesn't it? You know, this woman has borne a child to him, and he just gives her a skin of water and a bit of food and says, you know, on your bike. Really harsh. There's so much in that passage that I haven't got time to talk about, but particularly it talks about God's timing, and it talks to us about when God's made a promise, he's going to keep that promise in his timing, and actually how desperately dangerous it is for us to try and take matters into our own hands and force God. We can't force God's timing. And that's a lesson that I'm having to learn over and over again. God is in charge. It's God's timing that's the most important thing. And it's really important not to have a good idea. When God's spoken, trust that God is going to come through for you. Right, we've got AI to thank again, because we're coming on to the main story now. That was just the introduction. This is the story I want to talk to you about. And this is a Polaroid photograph of Abraham and Isaac going up. No, it isn't actually, because I don't actually really like this depiction. Because I actually believe, and many Bible scholars would concur with this, that Isaac was considerably older than that boy in that picture appears to be. I guess there it's showing a boy kind of 12, 13. A lot of people think that Isaac would have been late teens, possibly even 20, when this story actually happened. So let's read the story from Genesis. It's not actually Genesis chapter 22. I thought it said 12. Haven't got that in my notes. Right, so we're now in Genesis chapter 22. Now it came to pass after these things, i.e. the whole thing of Hagar and Ishmael and being sent away, after these things, that God tested Abraham. So this is a few years later on in the story. God said to him, "Abraham," and he said, "Here I am." Then he said, "Take now your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love, and go to the land of Moriah, and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I shall tell you." So much in those two verses. First thing I want to ask you is this. Do you think God still tests us today? He tested Abraham in an incredibly dramatic way. Possibly God doesn't test us quite so dramatically. I don't know. Do you think God tests us by causing mishap in our lives? Or by causing illness? Do you think God tests us through that? This is my personal opinion. I don't believe that. I don't think God causes these things to happen. But I do believe that when things like this happen, God can use them for our own good, and God can allow us to be tested when certain situations occur to us. But I don't think it is God's will, and I don't personally believe that God actually physically causes bad things to happen. Sometimes they do happen, as we all know. Abraham's response was, "Here I am." He was ready to hear from God. Now, this is also interesting, because God says to Abraham, "Take your son, your only son Isaac, whom you love." Do you know, this is the first time in the Bible that the word love is used. It's the first time in the whole of the Bible that the word love is used. And the first time that the word love is used in the Bible is in the context of a father's love for a son who is going to be sacrificed. That's really very, very poignant, isn't it? The first use of the word love in the Bible is in connection with the sacrifice of a father's love and a son being sacrificed. It's also really important, in case you haven't kind of clocked this, that Abraham is told to take Isaac to the land of Moriah. The land of Moriah. If you look in 2 Chronicles, don't look it up, but I can give you the reference. If you look in 2 Chronicles, chapter 3, verse 1, we read the story of Solomon, who was King David's son, building a temple. And it says this quite simply: Solomon began to build the temple of the Lord in Jerusalem, where? On Mount Moriah. So if you hadn't realized, we can't be geographically precise to the sat-nav pointing us to the exact square inch, but what we do know is that Isaac was taken to the same area where hundreds of years later Jesus himself would be taken. Jerusalem was built, and Jerusalem is on Mount Moriah, which is actually where Isaac was taken to be sacrificed, and of course where Jesus was sacrificed. Child sacrifice was actually quite common in those days, and perhaps one of the reasons God called Abraham in this way was to prove that he was nothing like a pagan god, but the people in that area regularly were sacrificing their children to their gods. Abraham had a lesson to learn. He had to realize that there is a difference between trusting the promise and trusting the promiser. That's really very, very important. He had to know the difference between the promise and the promiser. Abraham had to trust God more than he had to trust God's promise. Sometimes when God speaks to us, we can put God's promise before God himself. We think we have to act to bring things about, which is what Abraham had done. He kind of felt, I've got to have kids because, you know, God's promised it, so I've got to do something about it. Abraham had to learn through this lesson, and he learned from this dreadful experience that he went through about trusting God, the promiser, more, even more than trusting in God's promise himself. Because God never breaks a promise. And sometimes we may receive a promise from God, and then we may be called to a course of action that in worldly terms may even jeopardize the outcome of the promise. We may have a promise from God, and then God tells us to do something which seems completely contrary to the outcome of the promise. But we have to trust the promiser. When God speaks and gives us a promise, he will bring it about in his own time and in his own way. So, continuing with the story, Abraham rose early in the morning. He saddled his donkey and took two of his young men with him, and Isaac his son, and he split the wood for the burnt offering. And he arose, and he went to the place of which God had told him. Then on the third day, Abraham lifted his eyes and saw the place afar off. We're told that Abraham went early. He didn't delay. God had called him to do something absolutely appalling. But because God had called him, he didn't dilly-dally, he didn't prevaricate, he didn't think, well, I'll get round to it. He got up early and went straight away. We get a little bit of extra information in this passage. Abraham saddled his own donkey, And he split his own wood. Now, Abraham was a 100-year-old man. And at this stage of his life, he was actually quite, he didn't own any land, but he was actually quite a wealthy man. He had lots of servants. He had lots of cattle, lots of material possessions. Abraham would nearly always have had people to put the saddle on the donkey for him. And specifically, he would have had people that would have split the wood for him. That would not have been a chore that Abraham normally did. But because God had called him, Abraham did it himself. And perhaps when God calls us, is there something special about actually getting our hands dirty ourselves? Perhaps if God speaks to us about a situation, the easiest thing for some of us is to perhaps just throw a bit of money at it or to, you know, try and deal with it, but very much at hands off. If God is calling us to serve and to help, is he actually saying, don't just facilitate it, but get your own hands dirty, just as Abraham did? One commentator I read about this said that Abraham split the wood with a heart that was splitting. But actually, the Bible doesn't tell us anything. If you read this passage, it doesn't tell us anything about how Abraham felt. We imagine how he felt, but the Bible doesn't tell us. Abraham acted on faith, not feelings. That's a huge challenge. That's a challenge to me. How often do we act on feelings rather than faith? How often do we obey when we don't understand? Also, thinking about how Abraham must have felt, he'd actually already lost one son, hadn't he? Ishmael had been sent off. Abraham must have had a heavy heart. The Bible did tell us that Abraham was upset about Ishmael, and God said, look, just do what Sarah tells you to do. Abraham had already trusted God and sent one son off. He must have had an incredibly heavy heart. But Abraham said to his young man, stay here with the donkey. The lad and I will go yonder and worship, and we will come back to you. We just read a few verses ago about the first word, use of the word love in the Bible, in the context of a father's love for his son. This is the first use of the word worship in the Bible, in the context of Abraham and Isaac going to the mountain. And Abraham says, we're going to go and worship. The Hebrew word that they use is shachar, if I've pronounced that correctly, which means to bow down. Abraham and Isaac weren't planning to go to the top of the mountain to have a praise party. They weren't going to be all excited, but they were going to bow down before the Lord. Sometimes for us, worship is fantastic. Sometimes there's nothing better than being in the presence of God and getting all excited about him or praising him or feeling that a tangible sense of his presence. Worship is a wonderful thing most of the time. But sometimes worship is deeper than just getting excited about singing songs and jumping up and down. Sometimes a real act of worship is bowing down and trusting God, and that is real worship. The Bible talks about a sacrifice of praise. Sometimes worship is the last thing we feel we want to do, but we're still being called by God to trust and to worship. Can you see there as well that Abraham actually said, stay here with the donkey, the lad and I will go yonder, and we'll come back. What? Well, Abraham thought he was going to sacrifice Isaac. Surely he would have thought that he was going to be coming back on his own. Yeah? He was going to burn Isaac's body, let's be blunt about it. So what does that mean? Abraham said, we'll come back. Does it mean that somehow Abraham knew that God was a gracious God and that this was only a test and he wasn't really going to have to go through with it? No, categorically no, that was not the case. In Hebrews chapter 11, there's a long list of all the men of faith, and it makes it really clear that Abraham believed that God could raise Isaac back from the dead. Because Abraham had received a promise from God. The promise was that through Isaac, your seed will come and the nation will come. And Abraham's faith was so strong that he believed somehow that even after sacrificing Isaac, that God would still keep his promise. That is unbelievably strong faith. And that's why it was credited to Abraham as righteousness. God looked at Abraham as a righteous man because Abraham had absolutely believed God 100%. So Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac, his son. He took the fire in his hand and a knife, and the two of them went together. But Isaac spoke to Abraham, his father, and said, "My father." And he said, "Here I am, my son." And then he said, "Look, the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for a burnt offering?" And Abraham said, I think we need the next one, do we? No, we go there. Abraham said, "My son, God will provide for himself the lamb for a burnt offering." So the two of them went together. So that's just a little picture of Abraham and Isaac there on the top of the mountain. Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac, his son. Isaac received the wood for his own sacrifice, and he carried the wood up the hill of sacrifice, just as Jesus did. The Bible tells us that the two of them went together. The Hebrew word there literally means that the two of them went in agreement, in one accord. Abraham and Isaac went together, and Isaac went knowingly and willingly. The phrase is repeated twice for emphasis. Then they came to the place of which God had told him. And Abraham built an altar there and placed the wood in order. He bound Isaac his son and laid him on the altar upon the wood. And Abraham stretched out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. As I've already said, Abraham was well over 100 years old when he took Isaac to the top of that mountain. Isaac was a young man in the prime of his life. He would have been able to escape. He would have been able to run off. But Isaac submitted to his father's will perfectly. And in remembering Abraham's faith, we shouldn't also forget the faith of Isaac as well. Just as Jesus did, Isaac went willingly. But the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven. He said, "Abraham, Abraham." He said, "Here I am." He said, "Do not lay your hand on the lad or anything to him. For now I know that you fear God, since you've not withheld your son, your only son, from me." Then Abraham lifted his eyes and looked, and there behind him was a ram caught in a thicket by its horns. So Abraham went and took the ram and offered it up for a burnt offering instead of his son. When Abraham was told by God, "Don't lay your hand on the son," he was proving categorically he was not like the God, the pagan gods of the Canaanites and the other gods that wanted human sacrifice. God was demonstrating he didn't want a human sacrifice. When God asked Abraham for the ultimate demonstration of love and commitment, he asked for Abraham's son. There was nothing greater that he could have asked Abraham to give. When God the Father wants to show us the ultimate demonstration of his love and his commitment to us, he gave his son for us. We can say to our Lord, "I know you love me because you haven't withheld your son." Just as Abraham was prepared not to withhold his son, God himself did not withhold Jesus. That was demonstrating the depth of his love for us. So Abraham went and took the ram and offered it as a sacrifice. God still required a sacrifice. He didn't call off the sacrifice, but he provided a substitute. And again, we just see that so much in Jesus. And then the last verse of the story, Abraham called the name of this place, "The Lord will provide." And as he said to this day, "In the mount of the Lord it shall be provided. I love the fact that Abraham called the mountain the Lord, the mountain of provision. He didn't name the place with regards to what he'd experienced on the mountain himself. He could have called it the mountain of trial, couldn't he? Or the mountain of agony. Or the mountain of obedience, because it was a trial. It was agonizing for him, and he was obedient. But instead, he named the mountain in reference to what God did rather than what he felt. He named it Mount Provision. He named it knowing God would provide the sacrifice for salvation on that hill. When we look back on our life's experiences, I'm sure that all of us have faced difficulties and problems. I'm sure many of us have climbed kind of metaphorical mountains in our life. We've had challenges that have felt like climbing a hard mountain. I wonder what we've called those mountains. I wonder when we look back in our mind's eye to difficult experiences and trials, are we actually looking back and saying, gosh, that was so hard, it was so horrible, I'm glad I haven't got to go through that again? Or are we looking back and saying, it was tough, but boy, God really came through for me? Perhaps we need to think of the trials that we've gone through in that light, in the light of what God did rather than what we went through. So Isaac's life was a complete picture of what Jesus did. They were both loved deeply by their father. They both offered themselves willingly. They both carried the wool, the wood, up the hill to their sacrifice. They were both to be sacrificed on exactly the same hill. And they were both actually delivered from death on the third day. Isaac didn't have to go through with the sacrifice, but he was delivered from death on the third day, just as Jesus, after his sacrifice, was raised to death on the third day. The difference between Isaac and Jesus is, of course, that Jesus himself was the sacrifice. Isaac asked Abraham, "Where is the lamb?" John the Baptist looked at Jesus and said, "Behold the Lamb." Jesus is the Lamb of God that was sacrificed for us. And as we read this story, we can hopefully get things from it that we can apply to our everyday life. We can look at the example of Abraham and how he responded and question if we respond in the same way. You know, I myself have learned so much from this passage. But the most important part of this story is the way that Isaac was a forerunner to Jesus. A father, God, who loves us so much, he didn't hold his son back. He provided the lamb. He was the sacrifice himself. He rose on the third day so we could have a relationship with him, so our sins could be dealt with. And there is only one response we can make to that, and that is to say, "Lord, thank you for dying for me. I give you my life." If you've not done that, you can do that this morning. If you want to respond to the sacrifice of Jesus, the resurrection of Jesus, please don't go from this place without responding. I just want to conclude, and I'm realizing that time is up, but there's just three very quick things that I want to say to you. As a church, and I believe this is really important, things that we can learn from this story. And I just want to tell you this, that I believe God has a promise for you. I believe that God has a position for you. And I believe that God has provision for you. That's a great Methodist sermon, 3 P's. Promise, position, provision. I'm not going to preach another sermon now, but I just want to touch on this. Abraham received specific promises from God. What has God promised us? The Bible is rammed full of promises. I didn't know Jeff was going to choose that song that says, "I will stand on every promise of your word." If you want to know what God's promises are for you as an individual, just open the Bible and they will flow out. One of our friends has got what's called a promise box. It's an old wooden casket and it's got lots of tiny little scrolls of paper in. And you take a pair of tweezers and you pull out a scroll and every one's got a promise written on them. You can actually get, nowadays, unsurprisingly, on the internet, an electronic promise box. So perhaps you want to Google that and get yourself a promise box. But our friend's got a proper wooden promise box. But you can get them. So there are God's promises to us as individuals. But what has God promised to us as a church? What's God promised to us in this area? We are seeing remarkable move of God in this very day and age. I've never shared this before in this church, but it's relevant now because I think you need, as a church, to be looking and asking God what specific promises he has for you. When we felt called to start Springs, we were given a really specific promise, which we've kept a little bit quiet about because, in one sense, it could be really misunderstood, and I want to make sure that it's not misunderstood today. Because when we started Springs, God spoke really clearly to us about one church, one heart, and one community. Now, that does not mean one church, does not mean Springs will be the only church. It doesn't mean that. But what it does mean is that God spoke to us over 10 years ago about this area, about there really being one church of God, working together with one half, working together to serve one community. And we are seeing that promise being fulfilled. And I want to encourage you as a church, as a church leadership, to seek God and ask him what promises is he specifically giving you as a fellowship, because I know that he has got specific promises for you. The other thing that I want to mention is this position. This is really interesting. Abraham was given specifically a covenant about a piece of land, which is still the promised land to this day and age. It meant a country that his descendants would be given. But for us as a church, position can actually mean different things. Yes, it can mean a geographical location. We've been given the authority in this land, this area of the land that we call Gornal. We are here as God's representatives, and it is our land. We've been given it, and God's called us to be here. So there's a geographical aspect to it. But also, are we being called to positions of influence? I believe we are. You've got people that come to this church that are school governors. You've got people that might be being called to become, I don't know, local councillors. You've got people that run businesses in this area. We, as the church, have a position of influence, and it's growing in the area. It is growing as we speak. And I want you to really seek God about the position that you should be in. And most importantly, position yourselves to receive God's provision. I believe you've done that, and I believe God's provision for this church is actually the fact that there's another church that wants to merge with you. That is amazing, and it's fabulous, and it's exciting, and I want you to really realize that that is God's provision, and you've been positioned to receive that, and it's dead exciting about what's going to be happening here. The provision for Abraham was a sacrifice. For us, it could be lots of other things. It could be finance. You were given provision for a new roof recently, weren't you? That was God's provision. It can be, you know, better facilities. But I believe passionately that and when I look at our own church, the number one provision that God has given us has been people. People are God's number one provision, because every ministry that the church undertakes requires people, and God will send you people for this time, that he will send you people that understand that the times that we live in, and you are being sent people at this time. And I just want to speak into that and say, as the merger happens, which is only next month now, realize this. Look, this is really important, folks. You need to be thinking about, what promises, what calling are you getting as a church? What should you be doing, and what should you not be doing? That's just as important. Just as important. Don't kind of try and copy other ministries. Seek God, and he will reveal to you exactly what his promises are for you as a fellowship. He will be putting you into positions of influence. He will be giving you the right place to be, and he'll provide. He is providing, and he will continue to provide. So we can learn all of that as well from this little story of Abraham and Isaac. My time.